International.
You're listening to the 11L Network and R&I from our Brooklyn studio.
New York.
From New York City, this is number one.
Boogeyman!
We love you. We love you.
Indeed. Hey, everyone. This is Dave the Boogeyman. This is the pre-show. This is the John Lennon pre-show. This would have been John Lennon's 70th birthday. Well, probably next week. But I like to honor John for his birthday. And I thank you, John. And I do remember you. We've got a great interview with John.
It inspired me completely. I got, as soon as she would sing something to me or play the cassette down the phone, I would, within 10 or 15 minutes, whether I wanted to work or not, if you call it work, I would suddenly get this song coming to me. And I always felt that the best songs were ones that came to you rather than... I do have the ability to, you know, if you ask me to write a song for a movie or something and they say it's about this, I can sit down and sort of make a song. I wouldn't be thrilled with it, but I can make a song like that. But I find it difficult to do that, but I can do it. You know, I call it craftsmanship, you know. I've had enough years at it to sort of put something together, but I never enjoyed that. I like it to be inspirational from the spirit. And being with Sean and switching off from the business sort of allowed that channel to be free for a bit. You know, it wasn't always on. It was switched off, and when I sort of switched it on again, zap, all this stuff came through. So now we're already... we did half... enough material for the next album, almost half as much, and we're already talking about the third album, so we're full of
vim and vigor.
It was very strange, just when we finished stringing the songs together, then in the next room somebody was saying, quick, come over here, because Starting Over is playing. So we just rushed to that room, and we heard it for the first time with that ting, ting, ting. By the way, that's the ting, 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 that's a bell for wishes. And if you make a wish, and you hear that ting, 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 and your wish will come true.
I was taking Sean and the nanny and the family to a little, except for Mother, who was here selling cows, in Bermuda to the botanical gardens for lunch, to the Italian restaurant, because I could get espresso and Sean could get some junk food. And I was just walking in, I looked down, and it was a botanical garden, and it said, we're in the office, folks, that's why it's buzzing. It said, Freesia, Double Fantasy. And it was some flowers. And I just thought, Double Fantasy, that's a great title. Because it has so many meanings that you couldn't even begin to think what it means. So it means everything you can think of. I mean, it's a double couple. It's real life, but it's still a fantasy because it's now in plastic and in photograph. And it's fantastic. And it's just it sort of seemed to be perfect for a title of the album. And there's two of us. And it just sort of says it all somehow without really saying anything. It says everything. And it's a flower, actually. So he's used to me being around all the time. Because it's a pleasure for me to hang around the house. I was always a homebody. I think a lot of musicians are. You know, you write and you play in the house anyway. Or as when I was wanting to be a painter when I was younger, I was all in the house, or write poetry. It was always in the house. But I started the work, you know, and he started seeing a bit less of me. I'd let him come to the studio, but it was a bit boring. He was excited, but long story short, at the end of the session, and it was going on, I got back on a night schedule where I'd be coming in when he'd be getting up. So he'd see me at breakfast, but I was a sort of shredded, okay, what, like that. And then one day we were sort of lying down on the bed together, so I'm maybe watching some cartoon or whatever. And he just sat up and said, you know what I want to be when I grow up? I said, no, what's that? He looked me right in the eye and said, just a daddy. And I thought, mm-hmm. I said, you mean you don't like it? Mm-hmm. That I'm working now, right? Mm-hmm. I'm going out a lot. He says, right. I said, well, I'll tell you something, Sean. It makes me happy to do the music. I might have more fun with you if I'm happier, right? I was saying to somebody the other day, there's only two artists I've ever worked with for more than one night stand, as it were. That's Paul McCartney and Yoko Ono. I think that's a pretty damn good choice, because in the history of the Beatles, Paul met me the first day I did Bebopalula live on stage, okay? And a mutual friend brought him to see my group called the Quarrymen. And we met and we talked after the show, and I saw he had talent, and he was playing guitar backstage and doing 20 Flight Rock by Eddie Cochran. And I turned around to him right then on first meeting and said, do you want to join the group? And he said, And I think he said yes the next day, as I recall it. Now, George came through Paul, and Ringo came through George, although, of course, I had a say in where they came from, but the person I actually picked as my partner, who I recognized had talent and I could get on with, was Paul. Now, 12... Well, however many years later, I met Yoko. I had the same feeling. It was a different field, but I had the same feeling. So I think as a talent scout, I've done pretty damn well. It was sort of 1966, and I got a call from a guy called John Dunbar, who used to be married to Marion Faithfull. You know, everybody's connected. And he had a gallery in London called Indica Gallery, an art gallery. And I used to go there occasionally to see whatever art show was on, you see? And he said, oh, I've got this, there's this fantastic Japanese girl coming from New York, and she's going to do this other thing, but she's also going to put on an exhibition at my gallery. And it's going to be this big event, something about black bags. And I thought, geez, you know. you know, these artists, they're all ravers. You know, it was in the days of happenings and paint and all that stuff, right? So, I go right down there, you know, for the opening, goody, goody, you know. You know, goes down, see what's happening. I get down there, and it's the night before the opening. I thought there was going to be a big party and an opening and the whole bit, you know, a big hat. I didn't want to get involved. I wanted to watch, you know. I get there, it's all white and quiet, and there's just these strange things all on display, like an apple on a stand for £200, when the pound was worth $8 or something or whatever. And there's hammers with insane hammer in it, and all this very peculiar stuff, and a ladder with a painting on the sky. Or it looked like a blank canvas on the ceiling with a spyglass hanging from it. So I'm looking around, and there doesn't seem to be many people. There's a couple of people downstairs, and I didn't know who was who. So I get up the ladder, and I look through this spyglass, and it said, yes. And I took that as a personal positive message, because most of the avant-garde artists of that period were all negative, you know, like break a piano with an axe. It was mainly male. I'm looking at the female here. It was mainly male art, and it was all destructive and, you know. But here was this little crazy message on the ceiling. And then the guy introduced me to her, and she didn't know who the hell I was. She had no idea. You know? She was living in a different environment altogether. And I was saying, well, I thought, well, this is a good con, isn't it? Apples for £200 and hammer and nail. Who's going to buy this? You know, I didn't know what concept art was, which in a nutshell is the idea is more important than the object. So that's why you won't see many rich concept artists around. So anyway, gallery owner was all fussing around. He was thinking, well, is he going to buy something? And she's ignoring me, you know. So he introduced us, and I said, well, where's the event? You know, where's the happening? Because I'd seen the bag. So she just takes a card out and gives it to me and just says, breathe. So I said, you mean that? She said, you got it. I said, uh-huh, all right, I'm beginning to catch on here. You know? That was the big event, you know, I mean, all the way from New York for that. So I see the hammer hanging on the thing with a few nails underneath. I said, well, can I at least hammer a nail in? You know, I've come all the way from the suburbs for this. And she says, no.
Because before the opening, she, and I wanted
well, it was
everything
before
to be
I
right,
didn't
you
want
know.
The thing messed up, you know. So anyway, the gallery owner has a little word with her, and she says, she comes over and she says, all right, no smiling or anything, because you know how she is. She's not running for office. She never was, so. She looks at me and she says, you give me 5 shillings. Give me 5 shillings and you can hammer a nail in. So I looked at her and I said, I'll give you an imaginary 5 shillings and hammer an imaginary nail in, okay? And that's when we connected really, and we looked at each other like, you know, that sort of, something went on. Well, I didn't see her again for a few weeks. We went to a Klaus Oldenburg opening, and I went with Paul, and I don't know who she was with, but I got separated from Paul, and I felt this sort of vibe behind me, and I looked around, and there she was, you know. And we were both very shy, believe it or not, and I don't know what I said. We said something. We didn't really get together till 18 months later. I'm 40, I want to talk to the people my age. I'm happy if the young people like it, and I'm happy if the old people like it. I'm talking to guys and gals that have been through what we went through together, the 60s group that has survived the war, the drugs, the politics, the violence on the street, the whole shebang, that we've survived it, and we're here, and I'm talking to them. And the woman song is to Yoko, but it's to all women. And because my role in society, or any artist or poet's role, is to try and express what we all feel, not to tell people how to feel, not as a preacher, not as a leader, but as a reflection of us all. And it's like, that's the job of the artist in society, they're not some alienated being living on the outskirts of town. It's fine to live on the outskirts of town, but artists must reflect what we all are. That's what it's about, artists. Or poets, or whatever you want to call it. And that's what I'm trying to express on behalf of all the men to all the women. Through my own feelings about women, when it dawned on me, you know, my God, it is the other half of the sky, as the late, great Chairman McDougall said, right? I mean, they are the other half of the sky, and without them, there is nothing. And without us, there's nothing. There's only the two together. Creates children, creates society. So what's all this BS about, you know, women are this and men are that? We're all human, man. We're all human. Where's it got us all these thousands of years? Are we still going to have to be clubbing each other to death? Do I have to arm wrestle you to have a relationship with you as another male? Do I have to seduce her or come on with her that I'm going to lay her because she's a female, or come on, some sexual... Can we not have a relationship on some other level besides that same old stuff all the time? I mean, it's kid stuff, man. It's really kid stuff. And I don't want to go through life as a... pretending to be James Dean or Marlon Brando, you know? In a movie, not in real life, even in a movie version of them. Not only the fact that we got together and boom, it was like an explosion, but there was also the Beatle thing about us getting together and whether they split because of us or not, or whatever the reason, all that stuff. The Beatles were splitting, the Beatles were arguing, John and Yoko was getting together, the anti-Vietnam crusades were going on all over, and we were involved in so many things, and we were putting out so much work, and we were making movies, making public appearances, performing at shows, and traveling the world and doing all that. There was no time to reflect. There was only time to put out immediate impressions of what was happening.
Well, we were really honest about it. You can say that, you know, maybe we were naive, but still we were very honest about everything we did, you know.
That's why I refer to the word is love on Rubber Soul. Straight through to all you need is love, to give peace a chance, to imagine there's no countries, imagine no war, in other words, to write to this moment now. This album doesn't say imagine the whole world like that, because I've said that in a way. What I'm saying now is, now let's put the spotlight on the two of us and show how we're trying to imagine there's no wars, to live that love and peace. Imagine, there was a time, you know, when you didn't have to have a passport to go from country to country. What kind of world are we creating? Really, it used to be you could go around, you know. What is this game that you can't get, that somehow this is America and then just across the field is Canada, and that you have to have all kinds of papers and pictures and stamps and passports? And the concept of imagining no countries, imagining no religion, not imagining no God, although you're entitled to do that too, imagining no denominations, imagining that we revere Jesus Christ, Mohammed, Krishna, Milarepa equally. We don't have to worship either one, that we don't have to, but imagine there's no Catholic Protestant, no Jew Christian, that we allow it all, freedom of religion for real. I mean, the channels on the radio were jammed, you know. I was not getting clear signals. And after 10 or 15, almost 20 years of being under contract and having to produce two albums a year in the early days and a single every 3 months, regardless of what the hell else you were doing or what your family life was like, what your personal life was like, nothing counted. You just have to get those songs out. And Paul and I turned out a lot of songs those days, and it was easier because it was the beginning of our, relationship and career. Paul and I developed in public, as it were. We had a little rehearsal in private, but mainly we developed our abilities in public. But then it got to be format, and sort of not the pleasure that it was, and that's when I felt that I'd lost myself. Not that I was on purposely being a hypocrite or a phony, but it took something away from what I set out to do. I started out to do rock and roll because I absolutely liked doing it. So that's why I ended up doing a track like Starting Over. It's kind of tongue-in-cheek. You know, it's sort of a la Elvis and that, and I hope people accept it like that. I think it's a serious piece of work, but it's also tongue-in-cheek, you know. I mean, I went right back to my roots. All the time we were doing it, I was calling it Elvis, Elvis, you know, and it's not going back to being Beatle John in the 60s, it's being John Lennon, whose life was changed completely by hearing American rock and roll on the radio as a child, and that's the part of me that's coming out again, and that's why I'm enjoying it this time. I'm not trying to compete with my old self or compete with the young new wave kids or anything like that are coming on. I'm not competing with anything. I'm trying to go back and enjoy it as I enjoyed it originally.
We always had this a human race dream, you know, like we always wanted to fly, so now we have planes. And the next probably dream is wanting to be peaceful.
Well, the other great dream of mankind, one was to fly, which might have taken us a long time, but it took somebody to imagine it first.
Yes, kept imagining.
Second was reach the moon. right?
Yes, which we reached.
Oh. Now, it was an American in an American rocket, because that was the way history was at that time. But mankind had reached the moon, because they said one giant step for mankind. It was for all of us we went to the moon.
We were always saying, like, wanting the moon.
But nowadays, even football players are doing it, right? Which we were doing then, which is projecting the future in a positive way. What we were doing, you can call it magic, meditation, projection of goal, which business people do. They have courses on it. The footballers do it. They pray, they meditate before the game. They visualize themselves winning. Billie Jean King visualizes every move on the court. What we were doing, we were early pioneers of that movement, which is to project a future which we can have goals which we can reach. Right? People project their own future. So what we wanted to do was say, let's imagine a nice future. She's right. The males like even Aldous Huxley and George Orwell, who produced 1984, you look into Orwell's life, it was all torture and this, that, and the other, and he was brought up in a certain environment in a male-dominated society full of Marxist stuff about Spain, and they were all from the third, whatever, that period when they had those dreams of socialism answering everything. Right? And their dreams fell to dust after the war. And then they wrote these books projecting this horrific Big Brother monsters controlled by robots. And even now, these people that project the space fantasies are projecting war in space continually, with women in miniskirts, available sexual objects, and the men with super macho John Wayne guns on their hips. I'm saying it's time for the people to get hip to that, man, because they're projecting our future. Do we want to get our children to be out in space, or grandchildren fighting, maybe not Russians, but Venusians in space? You see, if it works for a football player and a tennis player, it can work for all of us. We have to project a positive future. I think that's what Christ and Mohammed and those people were saying in their way, in their time, for their society. When I do go through that terrible insecurity of the world is collapsing and going crazy, it doesn't make sense anymore. Wouldn't it be easier if I was just along with these people, this few hundred or few thousand that all think the same way, and it makes life easier like that? People realize that it's not the end of the world. The apocalypse is not going to happen, no matter what some person might threaten us with. Those people have been waving those end of the world. I remember the end of the world is nigh cartoons when I was 12, you know. My whole generation, our whole generation, was brought up with the H-bomb. I remember Bertrand Russell and all the H-bomb, and the reason that we were rock and rollers apparently in the 50s was because the bomb might go off any minute. You know, I mean, I don't think that's going to happen. I really don't think it's going to happen. I don't negate the 60s, I don't negate the 70s. The seeds that were planted in the 60s, and possibly they were planted generations before, but the seed that whatever happened in the 60s, the flowering of that is in the feminization of society, the meditation, the positive learning that people are doing in all walks of life. That is a direct result of the opening up of the 60s. The thing the 60s did was show us the possibility and the responsibility that we all had. It wasn't the answer, it just gave us a glimpse of the possibility. And the 70s, everybody's going, nya, 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 nya. And possibly in the 80s, maybe everybody say, okay, well, let's project the positive side of life again. You know, the world's been going on a long time, right? It's probably going to go on a long time. Hungry for making records because of the way I feel. I want to make some more records before a tour. So I'd like to make at least one more album before actually just making that final decision of calling those very expensive session musicians and taking them on the road, you know? Mm-hmm. But when I went in there, I had no intention of going live, because I've noticed a lot of people like Clash and things like that don't do any personal appearance hardly anymore, and they just make a video on the record. And so part of me would think, oh, right. But when we were playing in that studio, and then I don't know whether it was Tony, the bass player, or the drummer, after we'd done Starting Over, he said, can we do this again? I mean, let's take it on the road. And that was the first time it came. I thought, my God, this would be fun, wouldn't it? And if we can do it in the way we've done the album, which is have fun, enjoy the music, enjoy the performance, be accepted as John and Yoko, then I'd be happy to go out there. The reason this one goes ting, ting, ting is to show that I've come through. And whoever's listening must have come through or they wouldn't be here. And that's the... Because I always consider my work one piece, whether it be with Beatles, David Bowie, Elton John, Yoko Ono, and I consider that my work won't be finished until I'm dead and buried, and I hope that's a long, long time. So to me, it's one, it's part of one whole piece of work from the time I became public to now. And that's a, the connecting point between that. And the 80s, it's like we got a new chance.
Back to your local station for the Vons Value Price of the Week, now featured at all Vons markets.
Tide detergent, a 49-ounce box value price for just 89 cents at Vons. There's a Vons store near you at National Sepulveda Center in Los Angeles. Sounds like a disease. Ah, if you send us some info 10 days before your group's event takes place or give us a call, we'll let everybody know about it. So do it and we'll give you super service at KHJ. The next cut you're going to hear is a track from my new album, Walls and Bridges. It's the second cut in side two and features Elton John mumbling underneath me. Surprise, surprise.
Boogeyman!
When I was a little boy, way back home in Liverpool, my mama told me I was great. Then when I was a teenager, I knew that I got something going. My mama told me I was great. Was great. Yes, I'm in the British on earth for what it was worth. Yes, and I'm only 32, and all I wanna do is boogaloo. Hey! Tell me that I'm great. Yes, I'm Billy Shears. I've been for so many years. Yes, and I'm only 32, and all I wanna do is boogaloo. Hey! Was great.
I want to thank John Lennon. I feel that I still know him very well, and I look at him as a friend. That was a great interview. Thank you, John, for being. You'll always be in our hearts.
The Beatles decade, 1964 to 1974. Together and on their own, the Beatles. For 10 years on Capitol and Apple Records and Tapes.